our next speaker for this session is Dr. Todd Palicki from Stanford, and he'll be speaking to you of IMRT of the head and neck.
Thank you, Mike. That was an excellent presentation. I do have quite a few slides, and I know it's getting late, so I'll do my best to move through these rapidly. And I'll certainly be happy to stick around and take questions, but also if you want to chat a little bit afterwards on what I've presented here. So I'm going to move on with IMRT for head and neck cancer. And I'll try to cover several different aspects from why we do this to immobilization, similar to in the presentation we've just seen. One thing I am omitting here is the quality assurance aspect of IMRT. Certainly one can know that the QA is very similar whether you're doing CNS or head and neck or prostate, and there's several other presentations at this AAPM meeting that you should attend to get very specific input on quality assurance issues for IMRT. So why do we want to do IMRT for head and neck cancer? Well, it's a complex anatomical region. Normal tissues and targets are in close proximity, and there's certainly 3D planning aspects are inadequate for target coverage and normal tissue sparing. And there's no way to deliver concave dose distributions, which are important in head and neck. And one of the aspects that allow us to use IMRT more confidently in head and neck than, say, lung or the abdomen is the absence of organ motion. And in the head and neck, similar to CNS, we have all the optic apparatus in very close proximity, parotid glands, which are very important for quality of life, the oral cavity, temporal lobes, mandible, larynx, all of these aspects are next to each other and wrapping right around the target volumes. These are typical lateral fields if you're doing conventional IMRT or conventional head and neck treatment planning, and you abut that to an electron field, and you know that there's dosimetry is questionable at an electron-photon beam junction. Also, there's no way to do a concave dose distribution, so you can't shape. That's the reason why we need this electron field, is you can't shape the dose distribution adequately around the spinal cord to increase the dose to the target. Indications for IMRT, you definitely need cooperative patients. If you have patients with resting tremors or patients who are claustrophobic or uncomfortable in a mask, they're not going to be a good candidate because of moving. A reduction of normal tissues, tissue complications is an important aspect for IMRT, and there's plenty of literature in the data now, to support that. To escalate dose and improve local regional control is another indication, and of course, dosimetry aspects of IMRT can be much better than what we get with conventional photon electron beam matching. As I mentioned, there's little or no intrafraction organ motion, and setup uncertainty can be controlled to an acceptable level with IMRT without any heroic immobilization devices. Just typically what you find off the shelf is usually adequate to get yourself within 2 to 3 millimeters of accuracy. So let's look at some of those immobilization techniques and the issues surrounding immobilization for head and neck. For head and neck IMRT, it's not just one site. You're not just looking at immobilizing the patient's head. You also have to be concerned with the supraclav region because you're very frequently treating lymph nodes prophylactically all the way down to the supraclav or the mediastinum. So it's really a two-pronged problem where you need to immobilize the head, but you also need to immobilize the shoulders. And there's different ways to do that. You can have active types of immobilization where you actually fix the patient's head by some device or fix the patient's shoulders. Or you can have more passive ways to do it. And an aquaplast mask I consider as a passive immobilization. It doesn't fix the patient's head, but it reminds them to stay still. Patient comfort is the biggest issue here, so that we implement a customizable head holder so that we can give the patient the most comfort, and that would encourage them to remain still the longest. We also use a passive shoulder restraint device so that we have dolls that are customizable for each patient's arm position, and that just fixes their clavicles in the same position, and we count on the aquaplast mask to keep them fixed in their head position. And this is general conclusions from the literature. Head and neck can be immobilized in 1 to 2 millimeters, shoulders can be immobilized in 2 to 3 millimeters. If you use some type of infrared tracking device or motion detection device. This can also be decreased down to the submillimeter level, and that's been shown in some radio surgery applications. But this variability has to be taken into consideration in the treatment plans by adding adequate margins to ensure that you have coverage and you're not over-irradiating the normal tissues. In terms of tissue segmentation, there's three aspects of this: the target volumes, normal tissues, and then image fusion that helps you draw the target volumes and also to some extent helps you draw the normal structures. So, for example, in an NPC case, we like to stick to using the ICRU nomenclature, starting with 50 but also moving to ICRU 62, where you're using gross tumor that's detected by physical exam or MRI, and then CTV, which includes all your regional lymph nodes, draining lymphatics, and sites of possible spread of disease. PTV should be determined based on your individual immobilization device in your clinic. So it's a very simple study to look at over several port films of a particular patient or setup films, APN orthogonal setup films, to get an idea of how your setup uncertainty margins are in your clinic. And once you determine what those are, you can set adequate PT margins to ensure target coverage. So these will be slightly different in each clinic, but 3 to 5 millimeters is certainly adequate. Also, moving to the ICRU 62 nomenclature, for head and neck cancers, we don't have this margin that is due to internal physiological variations like breathing, but we still have a setup margin that you have to add around there. We are not currently using, in terms of treatment planning, this planning at risk organ volume, but this is part of the ICRU nomenclature that you add a volume based on your setup uncertainty that you've determined from your clinic around your critical structures so that you can provide adequate coverage of or sparing of the normal structures. To very frequently in head and neck cancer, you have several different sites of gross tumor, sites where you want to deliver a high dose perfraction. And so sometimes you need to have a nomenclature to delineate several GTVs, either in the main head or even in the regional lymph nodes that might have regions where you want to deliver the highest prescription dose. The prophylactic dose will be denoted by a CTV, and CTV N1 and 2 are ways to still allow you to keep within the ICRU definitions and specify more than one target. Anatomy is a very important aspect. Certainly, that's in the physician's domain, but we also, as physicists of symmetrists, we need to be aware of what constitutes certain structures and also what their dose-limiting constraints are. Here we see brainstem, chiasm, optic nerves, eyes. Temporal lobes are an important issue. Brainstem is obviously an important issue. And it's helpful for you, particularly if you're starting an IMRT program or you have a new physician coming into your institution that's going to be starting IMRT at your institution, is to be on the same page of what normal tissues need to be contoured and what their dose-limiting structures are. Some physicians may not contour temporal lobes, but those are something that needs to be considered in treatment planning. So if they don't draw those, you know it still needs to be either included in there or at least you can pay attention to sparing dose at those particular regions. The parotids, we know, are very important to preserve salivary function. And it's also helpful to understand going from different structures and anatomically their location, what it means in terms of what kind of doses can be delivered to those structures. So the brainstem is part of the brain. It typically can take a higher dose than the spinal cord, but certainly at the junction here where the brainstem meets the spinal cord, that's not a very anatomical hard definition. So the spinal cord at level C1, C2 might be able to go higher than 45 gray or 48 gray, whereas as you get down to the lower spinal cord, you want to limit that to 45 gray. And a different aspect, this is one side of an AP radiograph. In the old days, we know we'd draw a supercleft field that looks like that. And you just take whatever dose you get, prescribing to D3, for example, over one of the clavicles. But nowadays, with IMRT, what you need to be aware of is the region where the brachial plexus nerve lies. And although this is not the nerve itself, it's the region where the nerve exits the spinal column. And if you're treating the lymph nodes and the physician has drawn target volume around this area, we all need to pay attention of not having any hot spots fall within a region where we know the sensitive structures are, even if they're not explicitly drawn. CT and MR, MR is primarily used for target delineation, and it helps you delineate the exact boundaries of the gross of the region of gross target. And here you can see it easily on CT. It's even easier to see the posterior aspect of that target volume on MR. And one thing I would encourage as you get an RMRT program up and running, and that is consistency. So you need to decide with your treating physician, do you want to contour spinal cord and add a PRV, or do you want to just contour the spinal canal, in which case a PRV, you might have a different PRV for a margin around that spinal cord. Just things to keep in mind as you get a program up and running, or you decide to modify a program that you already have in place. PET imaging is another aspect in head and neck cancer that's becoming very prevalent. And we know that PETs is very useful. Malignant cells divide very rapidly. They burn glucose preferentially. So if you can have a glucose analog and put a positron-emitting isotope on that, you can monitor the regions of high dose activity. Now, for most of us, usually not at 5 o'clock or 5:30, your brain is typically very active, and that's why this is very high. But the PET imaging also helps you get regions in the neck that are metabolically active. Now, this isn't metabolic activity here is a surrogate for tumor activity. So it doesn't actually image cancer cells, but it images the active cells, which we take to be cancer. So we don't use this typically for defining gross tumor volume. This is defined just for regions of active tissue, which we take to be tumor. And it's very easy to have different treatment volumes based on window and leveling of your PET images. So you and the physicians need to be very careful about how they draw those targets based on PET images, based on whatever window and level is. There is no standard right now on exactly what constitutes tumor and what window and level you should put to draw that target volume. So in terms of useful advice for imaging, if you can participate in the setup and imaging of the patient for the different modalities, this is often very difficult to do, but if you can, ensure that the positions of patient is in the same position. And if you can't be there, at least understand what the restrictions on the imaging modality are. For example, if they're an MR scanner, do they have a different head position and neck position than if they had because of an MR coil that they had during setup? Before you start the fusion, talk to the physician about the site of interest. What's the location? It's not enough for the physician to give you an MR scan and say, please fuse it to the CT, the treatment planning CT. You need to know, you know, is this a pre-op? Is it a post-op? Is there a surgical defect? What site actually in the head are they interested in? Is it nasopharynx? Are they more interested in the neck region? These help you focus on what regions you need to consider when you're doing the scan, because very frequently patients are not in the same position and the scans are left. Fusing two scans manually is left to interpretation of the user. Once that's done, though, you need to communicate your uncertainty in your fusion. And this doesn't need to be quantified in terms of a millimeter or two. You can sit down with the physician and step them through your thought process on how you did fuse the two images and where you think you might be in error and where not. And they can take some of their clinical knowledge and help them draw target volumes based on your communicating the uncertainty. That moves us towards treatment planning. And before the planning begins, it's helpful to ask, is this case appropriate for IMRT? Again, we talked about what cases are useful, but you also always want to discuss, is this a good patient to lie still for 30 minutes or 40 minutes on the treatment table if necessary? Where is the target to discuss potential beam angles or what issues might come to you before the treatment process begins? And then you want to get an idea from the physician on what target doses are they going to be treating to and what's the normal, acceptable normal tissue doses. Sometimes these aren't always standardized within the department, or each patient may have its own situations that require different dose limits. So communicating with the physician is of the utmost importance. And then what's the plan? Is it a simultaneous integrated boost? Is it a sequential going down plan? These things need to be decided up front. So there's usually the same primary target as with the 3D conformal therapy. It's just a matter of how you deliver the dose to those regions. So the this is in the under the physician's purview, but they will draw the regional lymph nodes that need to be covered with IMRT. And as I mentioned, the issue has to be made, question has to be answered, is it a simultaneous integrated boost or is it a sequential boost? And there's some data in the literature to show that a simultaneous integrated boost actually gives you a little bit better conformality and a much easier treatment plan rather than a sequential boost where you do two plans sequentially and then add them together. And in terms of the physician, it's certainly new physicians. It's difficult to sometimes help them understand. Newer ones are much easier to work with than perhaps senior physicians. But it's helpful to communicate to the physicians what kind of expectations they should have on IMRT treatment plans. A lot of times they hear the literature or they see presentations like this and they think that IMRT is going to solve all their problems. But that's just not the case. So certainly they need to be prepared for the fact that IMRT isodose lines are much more wavy and not as apparently homogeneous as 3D IMRT plans. And you can't move isodose lines very easily by just like you could by moving a block edge. You have to go back to the initial planning stages and increase dose constraints, add tuning structures in order to help you get a good plan to move those isodose lines. Some issues with IMRT treatments is that certainly can be a time-consuming treatment or planning process and quality assurance procedures. This time does go down as you gain more experience. And there's also many factors that have to, in plan evaluation, that are of uncertain significance. So this is something where you need to be on the same page as best you can with your physician so they know what you're able to provide and you know what they're asking for clinically. And typically, IMRT, the general idea of the shortcoming of IMRT is that you're going to exchange a large volume of a patient that's going to get a low dose to get better conformality or better targeting. Tissue inhomogeneity corrections are another issue, and it's a question that I get often when people are looking at an IMRT program. And I would refer to you to this AAPM report, Tissue Inhomogeneity Corrections for Megavoltage Photon Beams. It's a large document, but it's very comprehensive, and it answers many, many questions about heterogeneity issues, not in conventional plans, but also in IMRT plans. In general, though, a 4 to 10% error in relative electron density only results in about a 2% error in dose. So this is kind of a secondary question if you're really concerned about that. CT streaking artifacts are another problem. And those CT streaking artifacts due to dental fillings, et cetera, certainly change the dose distribution in the region of the streaking artifact, but typically don't affect the dose volume histograms very much. So typically, we ignore these. The only time I don't ignore these, and I'll actually contour streaking artifacts and remove the density and set it to water, is if the target is very small and just centered in the region of the streaking artifacts. Otherwise, I typically just proceed without doing anything special for the streaking artifacts. In terms of dose calculation accuracy in IMRT, there is a subtle theoretical issue where if you optimize on using a dose calculation algorithm that's less sophisticated, more approximate, using, for example, an unsophisticated pencil beam algorithm, and you do the same optimization using an accurate, for example, Monte Carlo dose calculation, the final result will be that the Monte Carlo dose distribution will give you a better optimized plan than the conventionally calculated dose distribution. This is because there's what's called a convergence error where you're optimizing on inaccurate beamlets. In practice, I wouldn't worry about this too much. Most of the planning systems, even the ones that have a pencil beam algorithm implemented, are accurate enough to within a few percent, certainly 3% for the systematic error, it's not a significant issue. It's one of those things, if you can have an accurate convolution superposition algorithm implemented in your computer, it's something to put on your to-do list, but not mission critical in order to get an IMRT program up and running. Before you start planning, it's helpful to sit down with your physician or at least by yourself to know what the published dose limits are and agree on what those are up front so you can have something to work towards that's not a shifting target as you're doing your treatment plans. And if you're getting chemotherapy, these typically need to be decreased by 10%. In terms of getting a good treatment plan, there's a host of things that you can do, from obviously changing your dose volume constraints, adding your number of beams, orientations, tuning structures, collimator angle, isocenter placement, beamlet size, intensity levels, and direct modification of intensity maps is another way to get an acceptable treatment plan. It depends on what's being required. So does more beams equal a better plan? In general, yes. And I think there's at least one paper in the literature showing that tomotherapy is getting even a more conformal plan than you can with nine-field cone beam treatment plan. And that's shown, you can see that a little bit in this slide, going from three-field to five-field to seven-field, where the conformality, just in a global sense, the conformality of the isodose curves and sparing of the normal structures is better in the seven-field plan than it is in the three- or five-field plan. This number of fields has to be balanced against how long the treatment time is going to be, too. If you're going to have a 9- or 12-field IMRT plan, can the patient be expected to lie still on the table for that length of time? That's something that needs to be decided on a case-by-case basis. In terms of beam orientation, coplanar versus non-coplanar, you have to ask yourself, what is the ease of setup? Nowadays, if you're doing image guidance and you have a KV imaging system on your planning on your linear accelerator, some of the implementations of those require that the table be in the standard position, 180 position. So that may be an argument against not using non-coplanar fields. And then, of course, equispaced versus selected beam angles, you have to be careful about having a standard equispaced beam orientation that goes through immobilization devices may give you problems with the dose distribution that you don't even see in the treatment planning system. So those are things that should all be identified as you're commissioning your IMRT or doing new cases. So this is a case I've done recently. This is trying to deliver 40 gray to this target here. I tried a five-field IMRT plan to cover the target, and I had this little hot spot outside the region in the brain. So I did some tuning structure, added some other structures to help control the dose, and we'll get what a tuning structure is in a second. And with that same beam orientation, I had a little deficit then in the target coverage. But same optimization parameters, same structures that I had on before. All I did was change this beam angle, and I got some nice coverage to the target volume. So little things, little changes that apparently shouldn't make a big difference sometimes do in IMRT, and it's worth giving those a try. Collimator orientation is another one. If you have a structure like this brainstem or spinal cord and you have a hot spot nearby, sometimes you can rotate the collimator angle so that the leaves travel perpendicular to the length of the structure, and that will help you reduce a hot spot in this region. So that's just one issue of being able to get a better resolution of the intensity map. You're not counting on, if the leaves are traveling in this direction, you're not counting on the fact that you have a finite leaf width in order to modulate the intensity at this region. A tuning structure. There's many names for these things that you'll see in the literature. Q-block is another one. Every institution has their own. Phantom structure is another one, has their own issue. But essentially what it is when you're doing IMRT, you're optimizing based on dose volume constraints to certain structures that are in the CT scan. We typically put all of our normal tissues on after the target is drawn and use the normal tissues to help conform the dose distribution to the target. But in practice, that's actually not even necessary. You can, if the physician gives you a target and they don't put on any normal structure, you can still get a very good IMRT plan just by adding tuning structures around the target volume and doing an optimization on a phantom structure. So this is one case where you can see that the target is in this region. There's a hot spot far outside the target on that side of the patient. You can add a structure like you see drawn here, and just do a reoptimization, including this structure with some dose volume constraints, and end up making a conformal dose distribution. So you can see you can do that without even having any normal tissues in place. And a lot of times you can get just as good a plan as if you're going to add all the normal tissues and find out what the eventual dose is there. Another thing that you can use, and this is something you'll have to work out with your physician, is that you actually break up the target and use that as as a tuning structure. So here you have a gross target, and then we have a region that we call CTV60. So around the gross target, we want to make sure we cover part of that region with at least 60 gray. So we put another target there. Here's a side shot of that, and the blue is the CTV60. The red is the target that gets 66 gray. Then we have the regional lymph nodes that are most likely for tumor spread. So these, we want to at least get 54 gray at 1 point gray per fraction. And then there's prophylactic irradiation of other lymph nodes where if we only get 50 gray or 52 gray, that's acceptable. But you can see if you break up the target volume in these different regions, it helps you control hotspots and get better coverage eventually. Isocenter placement is another aspect, which where the isocenter is sometimes can have small effects on your treatment plan. One of these plans, this plan actually has the isocenter located right here in the middle of the head, and this one has it shifted over in the center of the target, and you can see there's same optimization parameters and just rerunning it based on where the shifted isocenter is. You get a little bit more homogeneous coverage of the target region there as opposed to here. Another issue with isocenter placement is that it's not just about dose distribution. It's also about patient setup. So you don't want to choose an isocenter that's in a difficult anatomical place to identify on the DRR or on the KVMB image. So typically, you know, anterior vertebral body or somewhere in the head is a certainly good place, secure place to set the patient up. You don't want to set up the patient where you know you're going to have your maximum type of setup uncertainty, like down in the shoulder region. Number of intensity levels will affect the quality of the plan, depending on your, you know, how fast you want to deliver your plan or limitations of your linear accelerator. You might segment your intensity map into 10 intensity levels. As you increase greater than 10, you don't get much improvement in the dose distribution, at least seen in the DVH. And as you decrease those, you begin to decrease the conformality of your treatment plan. And that's just because as you decrease the number of intensity levels, you're losing resolution of your intensity map. Another aspect or tool in our bag of tricks to get good treatment plans is direct modification of an intensity map. And this is an intensity map for a case that I've done. The red is the high-dose regions. The blue is the low-dose regions. This is the target volume that the physician drew right near the eyes and the optic nerves. And you can see it here in three dimensions. And the physician's main concern for this plan was to limit the dose to the eye, get as much dose into the tumor as we can, but make sure we limit the dose to the eye so that we don't over-irradiate that region. So I did a very simple four-field plan and went through each four-field plan and just erased the intensity over the eye. So essentially it's just like putting a block right over the eye. And you end up with not a conformal dose distribution, but you're giving adequate. It's a trade-off that the physician was willing to make to still get adequate coverage of the target or what they deemed as adequate, but certainly sparing the normal tissues, which was the most important aspect in this case. Treating the supraclavian lymph nodes is another issue that comes up very often. And there's several ways to do this. There's three or four very good papers in the literature on this. If you download this presentation at the AAPM website, under each slide I have a set of references that refer to each of these sections. So I have the references that describe, you know, how to treat head and neck IMRT with supraclavian nodes, either including it all or using a conventional abutted field. And for some cases, this is what we do, where we have the gross target and we just abut an AP supraclav field to the IMRT field, about three millimeters inferior, so there's a cold match there. And the only thing we'd be careful of is that we don't do it next to any gross target volume. And we just look at the dose distribution from the IMRT plan and then set the IMRT isocenter inferior to that, or the AP supraclav isocenter inferior to that by a couple of millimeters. There's more sophisticated ways to do that. You can have a single isocenter where you treat the superior part of the target with IMRT and then the inferior part of the target with a conventional supraclav field. And the planning systems now, the 3D planning systems that do IMRT, are more sophisticated, so you can actually calculate the supraclav field first, include that dose distribution in your IMRT optimization, and have a better feathered junction here. And as I said, there's publications on exactly how best to do this. This shows the dose distribution from an AP superclav, and having to be careful not to have overlap of any hotspots there. And you can use all the tools at your disposal. Dose color wash is one, but also the dose line function that gives you this dose to see how you're falling off at a junction, so you don't have to worry about over irradiating the normal tissues there. And again, I refer you to these publications to see exactly how to include the AP superclav field into the IMRT optimization for optimal smooth fitting at this junction. So final comments on treatment planning. Beam energy, usually 4 to 6 MV is sufficient. I typically never use anything greater than that. I've tried a PA beam on occasion to, if you need to cover the superclav, using a PA beam to help cover the superclav nodes in an IMRT field, and you have a very large patient, sometimes a higher energy PEA beam will be helpful. And you need to be aware of things that you don't always see on the planning system where you're not sure if you can trust being skin dose. You can, with some immobilization systems that cover down to the neck, if there's bunching in that area, you can certainly have a very high dose there in skin reaction, something the physician needs to keep a watch on for during on-treatment visits. And moving on to plan evaluation. So when is the plan finished? What's the worst thing you can do when the plan is finished? These next few slides are very much kind of my own personal experience going through getting a plan, an IMRT program up and running and interacting with the physicians. What are achievable doses? That's something very important for us to keep on the tip of our tongue so that when we communicate with the physicians, they know that we know what we're talking about, and it just makes the whole planning process streamlined. And then I'll go on to some final comments. So when the plan is finished, what you don't want to do, I always make sure that I go through the plan with the physician there. That serves two purposes. Number one, you're able to understand, you're able to explain what you've done. But number two is you're able to ask them questions to understand what they want. A lot of times the physicians don't know what's achievable with IMRT, and they have a very uncomfortable nature with it. So the fact that they don't express exactly what they want on the first try is really not their fault. They don't quite know how to express it. So that type of communication is very important. The more time you spend talking with a physician about the plans, the faster you're going to get good plans for those patients. So I talk them through the plan. What do I like about it? What am I worried about? Where are the hot spots? Why can't I do certain aspects? Why couldn't I achieve the things that they requested? So I just make sure that I get in on the physician's decision process as much as possible. You have to be prepared that a plan may produce a maximal dose that exceeds the so-called tolerance dose for a critical structure, but you need to evaluate what's the magnitude of that and where is that dose located. A lot of times for serial structures like the spinal cord, we have a maximum dose set at 45 gray, but we look at 1 cc of the spinal cord because what we're interested in is a reasonable-sized hotspot, not a pixel maximum. And related to that, it's always necessary to review the entire plan slice by slice, looking at the dose distribution. The DVH and the statistics is not good enough to review IMRT plans. You need to look at where those hotspots fall and the magnitude of those hotspots and also the coverage. Very general normal tissue constraints. These are similar to what Mike just presented. These may change based on your individual institution and your individual physician. Even amongst physicians, they may have certain different dose constraints, but these are very much something to keep in the front of your mind as you're doing treatment planning to help facilitate the treatment process. The more you know about the literature, the more you're able to communicate to the physician to help move faster on achieving a good treatment plan. And then you have to make sure that you use all available evaluation tools for treatment planning system. A lot of times we get into a rut just looking at isodose curves slice by slice. You want to look. You can certainly use your 3D dose display to very quickly find where hotspots are located and what's the magnitude. Are they spread out throughout the patient, which may be an acceptable thing? Are they clumped right near the target volume, which may be ideal? Are they far away from from critical structures. Sagittal coronal isodose display, color wash, and dose profiles, all very helpful in certain situations. So experiment with those when you have time. And something else to talk to the physician about, and that is be prepared to make difficult decisions. The things that we can do with IMRT dose distributions are unlike anything that you can do with a 3D treatment plan in some cases. So you can have a region that you want to boost the target, and you have the prescription dose right up against the spinal cord. Is this a good plan or is it not? That's something to decide with the physician. It may be that this patient is just very fidgety, in which case I wouldn't be comfortable with this. This patient may be the most laid-back, relaxed person, and you have a very quick four-field or five-field IMRT plan where this type of conformality would be acceptable. So two slides or three slides to sum up. The risk of secondary malignancies is not zero. I don't have anything better to tell you about that, but it's something to keep in mind, certainly for pediatric IMRT cases, if that comes up in your clinic. They also may depend on the relative comorbidities of the patient's lifestyle. Setup uncertainties have the effect in general of smoothing out hotspots because of what you're doing is kind of smearing out the intensity map. So you may change those hotspots and move them to another place next to an adjacent critical structure. So you need to be aware of that and, again, take some time to quantify your setup uncertainty in your clinic based on your immobilization devices. Interesting thing is in the literature you can see that the recurrences that people are finding for IMRT plans are actually in the high-dose treatment regions. It's not at the junction between the lymph nodes and the high-dose region. So we're not missing target. We're just not delivering enough dose there. So with IMRT, we still may be in a region where we're going to look for further dose escalations. And to that end, refinements in the IMRT techniques are still ongoing. And real-time adaptive radiotherapy is still far out into the future. That's still 3, 5, 7 years away where we can do that. So if that's something that you're thinking of waiting for, I think it's farther in the future, and you can proceed with IMRT and still give your patients a benefit of getting as much dose to the tumor and still preserving salivary function and other normal tissue issues. And lastly, these data are taken from a paper published by Mel et al. In Cancer. In 2002, approximately one-third radiation oncologists used IMRT. In 2004, that number has gone to three-quarters, and largely because, you know, implementing IMRT in a community setting is very much a doable thing, and there's a paper published on that by Jack Yang, and that kind of outlines one way to implement that. So with that, I'd like to thank you very much for sticking around. Thank you for your attention, and I'll answer any questions.
Hi. Sir?
Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Regarding the skin reaction and monitor units, would you please kindly make some comments? They typically, you see on a 7-field head and neck, about 1,000 to 1,100 mUs on 6 MV, I have noticed. And then with the 35, 36 fractions, we are talking a large amount of monitor units. And then how much one needs to worry about the high monitor units per fraction?
Yeah. The high monitor units per fraction is an issue. I mean, there's you don't, luckily for head and neck and 6X, you don't have issues of neutron production. And I don't think the monitor units, the high monitor units, are contributing to skin dose. That's more of a bolus effect from a mobilization device or tangential photon beams. But the high monitor units gives an overall, you know, background dose to the patient. So typically for, you know, adult head and neck patients, it's not something that we've been particularly concerned with. If we're treating a pediatric IMRT case in the head and neck, then we will pay attention to that, reducing the number of beams, but also paying attention that we keep the monitor units as low as possible, perhaps segmenting, you know, only 5 intensity levels rather than 10 or something like that. But I can't give you any quantitative information on that. It's just something we keep in our mind as we're doing the IMRT plan.
I got two questions. Can you comment on your estimation of errors in dose, like 0 to 3%, and for convergence, 3 to 6% on how you arrived at those?
Yeah, that's taken from a publication from Robert Dry and Paul Keel. And that's, again, if you download the presentation off the website, it'll have that reference in there that you can go see that. But they did a systematic study comparing pencil beam, convolution superposition, and Monte Carlo. And those data are from their publication. So that's where the 3% systematic error comes from and where the 6% convergence error comes from.
The second question is related to drawing of the contours. If you have a GTV and then CTV and then PTV, does the PTV contains both volumes, or would you prefer not to include the GTV and CTV in the PTV just to help the optimization?
I include them all. Every time, so it's the CTV contains the GTV, the PTV contains both the CTV and the GTV. If you separate them out, then number one, you don't get a true, you know, PTV dose distribution because it's PTV minus GTV. So that's one aspect. But also the optimization, I haven't been as successful at getting good treatment plans if you do that. So on both fronts, it's better to just keep them all within the same target. Not the same target, but you know what I mean, sequentially included in one another.
If you expand the organ at risk to have a PTV around it, and then if you end up overlapping with the target structure, how do you deal with the overlap of the two?
That's a great question, and that is part of the communication that you need to have with a physician. The question before them that you have to act on is, do you want to treat this target, or do you want to spare the normal tissues? And there's no good answer for that. It's a clinical decision. But it's something that and it's not an easy decision for the physician to make, because you ask them this question, you're like, well, can't you do both? And the answer is, of course not. But a dialogue will help decide that. But it's a decision that they have to make that you need before you do the treatment plan.
I know we're running late, but...
I'm good. I could stay as long as you guys want.
You talked a little bit about having the different... You had a slide where you had CTV, you had your GTV, and then some CTV to some dose, 54, CTV,
yeah.
45. When you do that, and I've heard some mention of, and you briefly said something about it, but I wanted to know if you would comment a little further on looking at the dose per fraction then for those areas, because sometimes you could get well below your 1.8 gray or whatever. What do you look at, and...
Right.
How do you deal with that?
Yeah, again, more discussions to have with your oncologist. We want to ensure definitely that gross targets, in our case, we treat to 66 and 54 in general. So that's 2.2 and 1.8. So a gross target absolutely has to get 2.2. The regional lymph nodes that are suspected for disease definitely want to give those 1.8. What we found when we include the whole nodal region, it's very difficult to control the dose to both sides of the neck. If one is more susceptible to tumor spread, you want to make sure you get good coverage to that one. The other one can take a little bit lower dose, even if it's less than 1.8 gray per fraction. So in our case, our oncologist is prepared to limit the hot spots on the contralateral side, for example, in the CTV region. You don't want to have, 2.2 gray per fraction anywhere in that region. So she'll accept a lower dose and not have higher hotspots in that region. So I don't know if that's answering the question.
Yeah, that is, and that's something that you're looking at and you need to discuss with the clinician, but they have to just decide that get lower dose per fraction in certain areas.
I mean, if I was working with a new physician, they would draw the whole thing, and especially if it's a brand spanking new physician, say, okay, I'll give it a shot. And then they'll look at the contralateral and say, oh, you have a high dose right over, the brachial plexus nerve. This is not good, and then you can tell them, listen, here's something that may work. I can give, 1.7 gray per fraction to the contralateral side and control the hot spots if you want to, the suspected regions of lymphatic spread, I can promise you 1.8 gray per fraction to those regions. And they might take that. They'll see the dose distribution and say that's the way to go. So that's maybe a way to proceed in that case.
Right. Great, thanks.
Quick comment, maybe not a quick answer. If we treat at least to some dose the potential lymph nodes with electron beam, we can spare the deep-seated lesions. Have you looked at combining electron beams to improve the dose improve the treatment plan?
Yeah, that's a good question, and you're right. There's not an easy answer to that. No, not yet, but I can imagine a case where you can. All of the treatment planning systems are implementing a electron Monte Carlo dose calculation algorithm. And before that, I would never trust an electron beam, Fermi-Agius-based electron beam calculation of a dose distribution in a patient. But with Monte Carlo, that raises the bar a little bit. And there could be an instance where you boost a certain nodal region, not a region, but if there's a superficial lymph node with an electron beam after you've done an IMRT plan, or perhaps you calculate the electron beam first and then do an IMRT based on that electron beam dose distribution, you might end up with a better plan. I mean, there's many different tools that are going to be available to us in the future as we move forward, as these techniques become developed. Great. So thank you again for sticking around. I guess this closes the session. Thank you.